Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we are committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. I'm your host, Andrew Rizza, an allied healthcare professional with over 25 years of experience. My career has primarily spanned private physical therapy and public school athletics. Driven by curiosity and a passion for the industry, I created the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast to explore the ever-evolving landscape of healthcare with a focus on sports medicine, physical therapy, athletic training, and sports science. Each week, we'll dive into the challenges healthcare professionals encounter and discuss how collaboration can enhance understanding within the industry. Our goal is to improve the experience for patients and athletes alike. Now, on to the show.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Sports Medicine podcast. This week, I have Dr. Nick Patel. Dr. Patel is a physical therapist who works as an executive director for the Alliance for Physical Therapy, Quality, and Innovation, better known as APTQI. He received his master's degree in physical therapy from the University of Texas Health Science Center, San Antonio, and his doctorate in physical therapy from A.T. Stills University. His passion lies in the outpatient setting and has spent the majority of his career working with some of the largest providers in the country. He is also one of the very few people in the country who is a licensed physical therapist and also a registered lobbyist. I felt like today would be a really great conversation as we're going to talk about some legislative changes that needs to happen, you know, within our profession of physical therapy, but also for the elderly with a lot of fall risks and opioid addictions and things of that nature. And I actually hadn't formally met Dr. Patel, but he spoke as a keynote address speaker for our company, TIPT. Back in January, and I thought his conversation to us was fantastic. So I reached out to one of my colleagues for the introduction, and Dr. Patel was excited to come on and talk about this because this is his passion. Dr. Patel, thanks for coming on today.
No problem. Appreciate you having me.
Can you give the listeners just a little bit of background on how you end up working for APTQI? Because you are a licensed physical therapist and treated as a physical therapist for many years. Where was it in that part of your career where you said, hey, I need to do something different?
Well, yeah, it's a long winding road, but that's one of the nice things about therapy, right? You can do a lot of things with the skills that you learn. So I started off in an outpatient office-based clinic, and you know, that was the setting that I wanted to work in out of school. And I worked for a large company at the time that as time went on, they needed folks to kind of keep tabs on things and at a state level, legislature wise. And I've always kind of had a desire or I always took a liking to politics and the things of that nature, you know, from whenever I was a kid. So I volunteered to do some things like, hey, I'll go to the state house and offer to volunteer to testify for certain things. And I'll go talk to legislators. That kind of led to, oh, would you do it on the federal level? And I'm like, sure, I'll do that. And, you know, it kind of snowballs from there. And as your career sort of progresses, you realize, you know, where you feel like you're needed. And I kind of kept being pulled toward the advocacy side. And so how I landed at APTQI was, you know, ATI and a lot of other companies, USPH, Upstream, Athletico, Fox, Cora, the works, you know, sort of founded APTQI because they felt like they really needed a steady presence for advocacy for the office space or the outpatient setting. And they, you know, we had a couple of executive directors. And as, you know, they moved on to some other things, they kind of tapped me and said, hey, you've been around here for a while. You know, everything that we're doing from scratch, would you come in and be executive director? So I said, yes. And, you know, years later, I'm still here.
Yeah, that's great. I think one of the things that we had, you know, heard from you back in January is, you know, as a young physical therapist, you were talking about, you know, fall risk patients and, you know, how those people get the care they need. And some of those people end up just being almost forgotten. They look at my dad, who's elderly, and, you know, he's in the upper ages, he's in his beginning of his 80s. And you start to see these older adults that really are fall risk patients and they need the care that they need. And sometimes they don't get the approval to get that type of care. Like they might have PT come in twice a week because they can't afford it at home. They're in a, you know, a space where they're living that may be unsafe. And, you know, I think there's a lot more that needs to be done to be able to provide more for them because the aging population is growing. It's not declining. Right. So I think there's definitely some more things that we need to do as a profession. And that's where I think you come in and the rest of the CEOs and these big, larger companies that have a bigger voice. And I think that's where our conversation is kind of going today is, you know, how do you as an organization, as APTQI, help the industry? What are some of the things you do? We talk about, you know, is there fair reimbursement? Is there, you know, influencing types of policy? And then how do we promote best practices within organizations? Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, if you're a practicing therapist right now, especially in the office-based setting, you know how hard it is right now. We've been dealing with successive cuts. We've been dealing with, you know, administrative burden and things like pre-auths, things like, you know, payment policies that don't really make sense. And it's a tough time to treat patients. And it's easy to say, well, you know, all these things are happening because, you know, the government and payers are trying to get their costs under control. But we have to sort of realize, the thing that I realized that we have to do a better job of as a profession is to say, if the big picture is, hey, we spend a lot of money on healthcare as a country, and we do. And we have a lot of elderly people in our country and more every day, which we do. Those are facts. You know, we're coming up against a problem of how do we keep Medicare solvent and strong? How do we keep outcomes great or make them even better and serve this elderly population, but also make things more fair for the provider who has to give this care? And I think therapy actually sits at the intersection of all of those as the solution. If you want Medicare to be stronger fiscally and be on more solid footing from a financial point of view, you have to utilize lower cost providers, right? If we have more and more elderly folks coming in to our population every day and falls the number one cause of injury-related death for that population, they're the number one cause of hip fracture, the number one cause of wrist fracture, the number one cause of TBI. If you have this huge, you know, condition or this huge injury as a driver for all of those injuries, which also drives all the cost, because by the end of the decade, we're on pace for $100 billion a year in spend for medical care on just falls. And again, if all these things are happening, we need to make Medicare more solvent. We need to treat our patients better against the things that are hurting them the most. And we need to use low-cost providers to treat them. There is not a box that therapy doesn't check. Mm-hmm. The thing that we have to make sure we do is make sure other people know that. And so when I talk about therapy, when I advocate, when I talk about therapy, when I talk to other therapists, when I talk to other companies in our membership, it's with the purpose of saying we need to align ourselves with the solutions for the problems our country is facing. You need Medicare to spend less money. We should probably use more therapy. You need our elderly patient population to be better taken care of. We probably need to look at therapy. You know, you need to address the fact that that opioid use is associated with the injuries that falls, you know, cause. Therapy is your way to avoid that. And I think that's the thing that makes it go from, you know, politics is ugly and I'm not really comfortable talking about it and I don't really like the way things work in DC to we're the folks that need to actually bring the change that we'd like to see. We're the folks that can actually present the solutions that really decision makers are clamoring for. And sometimes when we go there, my biggest pitch or my biggest point that I'm trying to land to them is I'm not just coming here saying you need to pay therapy more. I'm coming here to tell you therapy saves money and you need to save money. Therapy saves people's independence and saves their functional status. You need the elderly to stay out of the hospital more. You need the elderly to be more independent. You need the elderly not to have to move back in with their parents or go to a nursing home and be as long as possible independent. I feel like that's it's a great story to tell. We just need to tell it more.
Yeah. And, you know, you talk about independence and I'm going through this with my dad now. He's independent, but as he's getting older, the ability for him to be independent is getting less and less. So if we had these, I guess, processes in place, it would make it a little easier. And now you're at the other side of it where they've been in the hospital and they've had injury. Now you're working backwards almost, right? And it seems like it's the wrong way to go. But I think, you know, we talk about these, you know, house bills that go up to legislation and how do we look at these and how they're written? And it's a long list of, you know, when they propose a bill and they have to go through and they have to either try to get it through the House and Senate. They redline things. It's public hearing. There's, you know, constituents that have to get behind it. And there's a lot of process. And I mean, I'm kind of being very short with how it works. It's very, very long if anybody knows government. Can you explain the SAFE Act? So it's the Stop Addiction or Stopping Addiction and Falls for the Elderly or short SAFE. And that's an act that APTQI and all these other CEOs are trying to bring to the legislators in constituents in Washington to understand that we need this. Can you explain to the people that don't know what it is, therapists that don't know what it is, even consumers that are listening to this know what it is and how they can help? I think mainly just how do we get more information? But I think describing what it is, how you are trying to get it on the Hill to get voted through to be something that we need to really get behind to make sure that people are getting what they need.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, if you're a therapist, think about every time someone comes into your clinic with the hip replacement that was due to a fracture, hip fracture from a fall, or, you know, the patient who came in post-fall with a TBI or what have you. What you most likely do, if you're like me and almost every therapist I know, is you say, you know, during your history, you find out the person's there ultimately because of a fall. And you say, you know what, we're going to have to add fall risk prevention and, you know, strategies to your plan of care. And you're going to go over their balance and their strength and talk about their home setup and the things they can do to make their home safer. And you're going to go through all this stuff. And that's great. And that's warranted. It's appropriate. It's what we should do to be a better practitioner for our patients. But, you know, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that we're doing all these things that we know reduce your fall risk to somebody who's already fallen, to somebody who has already taken the ambulance ride, went to the ER, got the surgery, is now going to be in PT for a while or OT. And it's kind of a shame to say, we have all these things we can do to help you not fall again, but wouldn't it have been better to maybe have done that ahead of time? Right. And so this, you're a patient and you're listening to someone tell you, I can make you reduce your risk for falls after you've already had all this pain in it. Or even worse, maybe you're talking to someone whose parent has died from a fall. And mm-hmm. to hear, have them know that there was something that might have reduced the person's risk from falling in the first place. That's a tough thing to listen to. So why don't we fix that? So what the SAFE Act does is say it sort of moves a fall risk assessment into the annual wellness benefit. So there's an already established annual wellness benefit for Medicare beneficiaries, which says that once a year, and when you get into Medicare, you get a visit that's no cost to you, to your physician. And, you know, they'll check everything. So you'll tell your physician if you have any problems, any issues, you'll get your blood work done, which will be no cost to you. The physician says, hey, you just told me your dad died of colon cancer and there's a lot of strong family history. You haven't had a colonoscopy ever. And you go get one. And it'll be no cost to you because I really want to incentivize you to go. But what happens when the physician says, have you fallen in the last 12 months? And the patient says, yeah. A box is checked that says patient fell in the last 12 months. But what where's the next step? Where's the, you should go get your blood work done. You should go get a mammogram. Where's that thing that says you should go get an assessment done, which might help you from the next time you fall, actually breaking your hip and having an issue? Because most of us know it's that second fall that really gets you. First time people kind of think they're just clumsy and they don't realize that that's a symptom of something that's more dangerous coming around. But what the bill would say is if that box is checked, you've fallen the last year during your annual wellness benefit, you can go to a PT or OT of your choice and get a fall risk assessment done. Like I said, you'll get your strength, your balance, your home setup. We can go walk through all that, put you on a home program if needed. And guess what? That'll be no cost to you as the patient. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about this is if you're a patient, again, it's not just about us. It's one visit. It's not like it's a windfall for therapists, but it's for the patients. And we even got a public statement of support from AARP because they realize how beneficial this will be for their members. And obviously, besides APTQI, APTA, AOTA are all supporting it as well. But that's what that would do. And they would sort of start placing therapy in some more of the preventative space in that wellness area and a little less always confined to, you only see a therapist when you've massively hurt yourself. And you've only seen a therapist that have downstream after you spent all this money on other procedures and other admissions. So in order to really unlock the value that therapy can provide the system, maybe we should move it up a little bit and put therapy before they actually accumulate all this spend and all this pain, unfortunately. So that's the bill in a nutshell. It's very simple. And people always talk about bills in Congress are thousands of pages long. SAFE Act is 4 pages. Mm-hmm. It's very simple. And the whole point is, if we can reduce falls, that should actually save not only the pain and the suffering, but it'll save us money. The average fall in the U.S. has a medical cost of about $10,000 per fall. This assessment we're talking about would be about $130 to $140.
Yep.
Most therapists I know can bat better than 1 for 70. If we can have every 70 assessments results in one less fall that year, it pays for itself. If we're a little bit better than 1 for 70, we're actually saving Medicare money, the patient's pain, I mean, all of it. So that's what I mean when I say we're sort of at the intersection of all the things that are kind of ailing the system right now.
Yeah. And it is a no-brainer. I mean, we all see it with our parents or even grandparents that have gone through this, you know, through their life. So it definitely, you know, speaks volumes to what you guys are doing. And I think the rest of the, you know, PT world is doing, especially the bigger corporations that have their you know, are in there collaborating together. It's not like they're jockeying for position. It sounds like they're all working together for one common goal, is to try to serve the public and try to make sure that people get what they need, which is amazing. And what is some of the feedback from, you know, the legislators and the constituents on the Hill? What's been the feedback that you've received?
Feedback's been great. Actually, it's really funny that you say no-brainer, because that's probably, if I had to tell you what's the most common reaction we get when we kind of outline the idea, no-brainer is the most common phrase that comes up from members of Congress. It's been bipartisan, which is always a great sign that it just doesn't seem to land with one party or the other, more or less. Members of both parties just seem to think that this is just a common sense idea. Mm-hmm. The receptivity to it has been great. It's also been mentioned to us that, you know, this is such a simple idea. I can't believe you haven't done this before. Like that kind of stuff. Like I thought we always did this. And when we explained it, not really, you know, they kind of say, well, maybe we should. So once we get a chance to explain it, I think the reaction's always pretty positive.
And that's great, because I think people don't know, right? That's what it sounds like. They, like you had just mentioned, like, oh, we thought that always happened. And I think that's right. A lot of our reaction to things, because we think it's already written in part of the healthcare practice or part of your healthcare plan. But I see it more often than not in outpatient physical therapy, is that people don't understand their benefit and what they have. And they think they have something, but they really don't, because they don't go through and read it and they don't understand it. And I mean, this touches everybody, because everybody has a parent or a grandparent, right? And I don't even know what the percentage of people that are at fall risk, if you took the consensus across the country, it's got to be over, like you said, over 65 is the highest rate of people with fractures, TBIs, you know, death, because obviously you're dealing with a lot of other things as they get older. You know, you're dealing with osteopenia, osteoporotic patients, you're dealing with other types of ailments that they may have that it pre-exists them to a lot of these things. People don't know that neuropathy is a real thing. Like, oh, my feet are numb, but I don't know what that is. And they go see their doctor and like, oh, you have neuropathy. Oh, we have poor balance. And again, this is something that we can do to kind of improve their health, but also their longevity.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, again, that's just part of making sure we tell our story. A lot of people do not know, one, the things that we can do. Sometimes I joke, I wish we could just change our name to like fallologists, because like sometimes I feel like, you know, if you tell someone you're a cardiologist, they know exactly what you do. If you tell someone you're an oncologist, they know exactly what you do. When you tell someone you're a physical therapist, you get so many different answers, right? Oh, you know, do you work in a hospital? Do you work in a schools district? Do you just work with sports people? Or, you know, you're the person people see after an ACL injury and stuff like that. And we do all of those things. But then I think sometimes it gets lost on the things that we do that like nobody else can do. Again, when it comes to falls, there isn't a healthcare provider out there that is as uniquely qualified to fix that problem as us. We can't kind of, but people kind of don't know about it because of that aspect of it. We just kind of get a better job of telling our story.
Yeah. And how does this bill incorporate, you know, reduction of opioid use? Is that in the bill or is that a separate
Correct.
Bill? Because I know there's been talk about that.
Yeah, it does address opioids in the sense that, so what, again, falls are opioid use in the elderly is heavily associated with falls. And the reason is, as we've already been talking about, because it's the number one cause of hip fracture and wrist fracture and TBI. So bone fractures hurt, headaches really hurt, and they are the gateways to some of these really powerful pain medications. And so we did a claims analysis while we were drafting the bill. And what we did was we took all Medicare population claims data and we kind of put them in two categories. The folks that had fallen were the universe, but folks who had fallen and got therapy afterwards and folks who had fallen who didn't. And we tracked them for 6 months after they were discharged. And the folks that had therapy after the fall, there was a 40% less likelihood that they would that they used an opioid. You know, I mean, this is claims data. So it means they got the prescription, they went to their drugstore and they filled it because it triggered a claim. 40% less likelihood they took those steps if they had therapy after the fall. So we know that if you reduce someone's fall risk, or you know that they have therapy after the injury, that they're not going to need these powerful, sometimes, you know, inappropriate, even in the prone to misuse pharmacological agents. So we know that if you can take a concrete number of hip fractures out of the universe and wrist fractures out of the universe and TBIs out of the universe, there's going to be less medications that are going to be needed for those. And, you know, I'm all for positioning therapy as an alternative to treating pain. But I think we also got to just have the conversation that let's just have less pain. Like, let's just obviate the need for it in the first place. If you already have the chronic pain, there's a role for us to help manage it without drugs. But I feel like there's also a way for us to help this problem by saying, let's just avoid the injury that led to your pain in the first place. And I think we have a, a place to be there.
Yeah, I think that's spot on because we talk about it here too, just for traditional outpatient, not elderly, post-surgical, like trying to reduce the opioid use by getting into therapy faster, helping to avoid some of those medications if needed. And then if not, go to a, you know, not strong or as strong medication to help the patient so they don't fall into that risk category. What are some of the other divisions? So once this, you know, act hopefully gets passed and goes through and becomes, you know, law, what are some of the other things that you're looking down the road for the organization to help with, you know, outpatient physical therapy practice? Is it within advocacy, other advocacy efforts or other more collaborations or innovative changes within the practices? What do you see coming down the road for you guys?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one of the things that we're working on as a long-term goal has been, you know, how we're currently paid. Does it make sense? Does it really make sense that therapists have to constantly count their minutes when they're working with patients? Are outcomes really affected if patients are dovetailed and, you know, whether they're seen in blocks where they're, I'm not seeing anyone else, or I can see someone while I dovetail the next person to come in? Is that really affecting someone's outcome or not? And if it doesn't, why are we constrained by, you know, those kinds of things when we can provide really good care still? Because as you said, patients are coming to clinics. We have tons of, and there's going to be more every year because of our aging population. And why are we constraining ourselves on these things just because that's the rules of how we get paid, right? And it's not really driven by the value that we can provide. So long term, what we like to do is investigate ways that we can change our payment model that reflect the most efficient way to deliver care that still gives great outcomes, but also to be rewarded for what we do. If therapy really saves the system money, every shared savings, you know, program from the government or from large payers almost never lets therapists participate in that, right? But we drive a lot of the savings. But it's a referring physician, and it's the surgeons, and it's the hospital systems which actually get to participate in some of those programs at the highest level. But yet we don't. And so I think that has to change. I think currently, if you're an outpatient provider, you're an office-based therapist, your payment is predicated on the folks who use the most expensive equipment get paid, their codes get paid higher. If you get sued from malpractice a whole bunch, your value is technically higher. Well, you know what? We don't use a lot of expensive equipment compared to the rest of the folks. We don't have a $120,000, you know, machine, which we put in the hospital in a therapy clinic. We don't get sued from malpractice a lot. We're actually safe practitioners. Like we do a good job with our patients and we're safe. But in the current system that we're in, you actually get penalized for that. And maybe that, you know, again, look at what's happened to us. We had like 11% cut over the last 5 years in Medicare. That's not really a sustainable pathway for us long term, I don't think. So in terms of innovative ideas and thoughts, maybe it's time for us to find a different way to get paid. Because there has to be a better way for a provider who uses low-cost equipment, who doesn't get sued a lot for malpractice. Right. You know, knock on wood, I don't want to jinx anybody. But like, there's got to be a pathway for those folks who actually save the system money to be able to participate in some of those savings and unlock some of these really archaic, antiquated notions of, you got to count every minute that you're with a patient and don't see somebody else while you're seeing this person. And even though you're perfectly able to, you're perfectly capable of getting a great outcome if there's some concurrent care, but now you're not able to because of an archaic rule. Maybe we should get away from some of that stuff. And that's some of the things that we're working on that I think are conversations we have to have for the long term, I think.
Yeah, and I think everybody in our profession will probably agree because they get most frustrated with the Medicare rule and how that works. You know, we discuss this quite often. I was talking to someone the other day about this and how Medicare, the CPT codes are, I don't know, 30 or 40 years old or however old they are, and they have never changed. And we were scratching our heads and we're like, well, things change. Like we innovate, we get better, we pivot, we get more advanced degrees, we learn more. We're learning more now than we did 30, 40, 50 years ago, even 10 years ago. So why are these still standard? Why aren't they changing and pivoting to the way the practices are changing and what we're adding? And 20 years ago, people weren't dry needling patients. 20 years ago, they weren't cupping patients. They weren't doing active release therapies like they do now. So how are we not changing some of these codings to be able to be more beneficial to the practitioner itself, but also to provide the care you need to provide for the patient? Because a lot of people are very afraid of Medicare. And when Medicare has these restrictions and rules, people are very, you know, it's very difficult, like you said, to treat that population when that population is growing daily.
Correct.
And we see a lot of Medicare patients, and it's more than we've seen in my lifetime because, again, they're aging. So there's definitely something that needs to be done.
Yeah. I have a feeling that if you went to the average therapist in the office space setting and said, you know what, forget all the rules for a second, manage these cases how you see fit, and you do it the way you feel like it needs to be done. Schedule them how they need to be scheduled, give them the treatments, and don't worry about minutes and whatnot. One, I bet you we get just as good outcomes as we get now. But two, we do it a whole lot more efficiently. Mm-hmm. And we probably get paid better as well because we're doing it more efficiently. And two, maybe we actually, if we manage the case, then we would be eligible for some of the savings that we actually do generate for other providers or other hospital systems.
Yeah, 100%. I also would piggyback on that and say that I think people's time spent in physical therapy would be less because you would treat them probably in a better duration, right? And you dose them more correctly instead of spreading them out because of the rules that are in place. So I think you definitely have a better, if not as good, better outcomes in that regard.
Yeah, and that's what we need to find out. I think that's where we need to go long term. Again, it goes back to your point. We really shouldn't be practicing in 2025 on rules that were made in 1990.
Exactly. And you know, the reason why that came up, we were talking about, I sit on the Board of Allied Health for the state of Massachusetts. So we govern ATP, TOT, and we talk about our State Practice Act. And our State Practice Act was written in the language in it. It's very broad stroke because you need to be able to innovate and get better. Because if you really pigeonholed somebody into a language, then you can't innovate and grow. And that's really the hard part. But I think they were really forward thinking in that regard. And in some instances, it can be tough if you do want to change something. Because you know, it's an act of God to change legislation.
Right, right.
So if we had something written that was not as broad stroked as it is, we'd have a difficult time doing some of the stuff we do now today in PT and in AT. When you're working with other, you know, all the organizations together, I talked to Sharon Vitti about this, and she had mentioned, you know, it's nice because everybody plays in the sandbox well together. When you think all these big companies that come together and sit down with you and you guys discuss these things, it seems like everybody is all on the same page. Like they all want to make their patients better. What's kind of been the common theme when you're dealing with all of those CEOs of those companies, when you guys come together and sit down, what's like the fishbowl like in the think tank? What is that like when you guys sit down?
That's a great question. Well, first of all, you know, ATI couldn't have a better advocate for their employees than Sharon. Sharon's great. Her and I were literally on the Hill this week, actually. I should throw out Chuck Thigpen as well. You guys have great folks behind you. But you know, one of the things about our membership, and we all are competitors. Don't get me wrong. Like, every one of my members competes against each other every day of the week. However, in our group, we have this culture that we've cultivated, and it's not really due to any one person. I can't take credit for it. It's sort of the culture that's been created, you know, through the members that have been there for the years and these executives, where we say, you got to check your ego out the door. You got to check the competitive differences out the door. When we meet, we are meeting to improve the profession on the premise that anything that benefits the profession is going to benefit all of us. Anything that's good for ATI from a policy change will be good for all of us. But when we all get together, even though as soon as you leave the room, we're all competitors again, but when we're together, we need to keep that focus. And, you know, the egos are checked at the door, you know, any kind of competitive, you know, pettiness, or that's usually all just checked at the door. Now, honest to God, I mean, this is probably the simplest explanation. Our execs are just nice people. They get along well because nice people get along with other nice people, and dedicated people get along with other dedicated people, and passionate people attract other passionate people. And that's what we have in our group as well. So when you get one of our members talking about their passion for what we do, whether they're a therapist or not, you know, I think once you're exposed to therapy, you get the picture. And you're able to see that passion in somebody else across the table from you, even though they work for a different company, you find a kindred spirit there and you want to work together. And I feel like that's the thing that has allowed us to endure for so long. I mean, to be honest, different incarnations of APTQI existed in the years past. They always just fell apart. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that has made this particular version endure for so long, and hopefully for the forever, is that there is this understanding that we can't just come together, fall apart. If we want to make lasting change, we need to come together and stay together. And that means, you know, like I said, you know, check some of these things out, check some of your biases out the door, and work together for the common good. And if we do that, it's going to be better for everybody.
I mean, it all comes down to innovation and collaboration, right? I think in any industry across, you know, all populations, whatever you're doing, if you're doing those things and you're at the same interest, I think everybody can pretty much get along for the most part. But again, you guys are doing fantastic things, and I think a lot of us are excited about it, which is great. As far as the industry itself, how do professionals really help with this? So outside of your organization, like just the memberships that are there with the big corporations, how do the therapists outside of it help? What would your recommendation be for, you know, the small mom and pop, or even the therapist just starting out? What is their role in this whole process of getting better and making sure that they're informing people of what's trying to happen, what we're trying to do with the industry to make sure that we're caring for the patients we're caring for?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things that people can do. And that's the beautiful part. You know, you kind of participate at the level that you feel comfortable with. Some of these things don't even involve much effort at all. Anyone listening to this, you want to go to aptqi.com and smash the take action button. You can go on there, send your letters in, have all your employees send their letters in, your receptionists, your sales reps, your billers. There's a section on there for patients. Patients can send them. I mean, maybe you get 10, 15 patients a week to send in letters. That's all great. But there's even a level beyond that. That doesn't take much. You can sit at your desk and get that done.
It takes
2 seconds. Right. But then there's another level there. And you know, let's say that, you know, you want to take a more active role. You know, we have membership in APTQI for, you know, smaller companies, maybe not one or two clinics, but we have members with like 20 clinics and 30 and 40 clinics, where they're not these super huge companies. And we have a place for you with us as well. If you go out and purposely try to develop a relationship with the office, and I say office, not necessarily the member that represents you, that's incredibly beneficial, because sometimes you don't need to get to Congressman so-and-so or Senator so-and-so. Get to their staff. They all have a district office somewhere in your area. Even you don't even have to go to DC if you don't want. Show up with some materials, and you can download any of the materials from APTQI website. I'm sure APTA has great materials, AOT as well, whatever you want to do. Show up and say, my name's Andrew. I want to talk about physical therapy. I have some materials I want to go over with you, and go over with it. Get their business card. Say, don't just leave. Then you say, I've been a practicing clinician in this area of Massachusetts for 20 years. I will be your resource. If you ever have a question about how healthcare policy would affect folks or patients, or a question about Medicare, you feel free to ask me. And you keep that relationship up a little bit. You know, regularly contact them, because what you'll find is then when you need something and you have an existing relationship there, it's easier to get some things done. And it's not just an anonymous call, which again, it's still important. But those emails and those calls have one level of effect. But then a call from someone who they have a relationship with has a whole nother level. Mm-hmm. And this doesn't require anything else than a little bit of time. Get on getting a little bit out of your clinic and going over to that office and calling over and say, I'd like to make an appointment to talk about a healthcare issue that's happening in the district. All of those things that happen in the district are funneled up to the DC office. And if the more and more they hear back that people here are talking about this, they start to get pay attention. Write to your local paper. Almost every major paper in America has a letters to the editor section or an op-ed section. If you ever see an article on healthcare and you feel like it's not even talking about therapy, right? Write a letter saying, hey, this is how therapy fits into that last article. Find reporters in here and say, come to my clinic, interview my patients. There's this bill out here that would make a difference in my patients. Newspapers scream for content. Sometimes they'll say yes, sometimes they'll say no. But when you get that article published, guess what? You're going to take that article and you're going to send it to the district director that you just met, that office, saying, hey, here's an article in the paper because people are talking about what I just told you about.
Right.
Maybe you're the one that invited them in, but that's right. Okay. But these are all things that I don't think we do very much of, but I think we should.
Yeah. Yeah. I 100% agree. And I think a lot of people don't know who their local constituents are either. Like maybe reach out to them and get to know them and befriend them, or, you know, try to learn more about where they stand on this, or they have to even know about it, right? The other thing that's so powerful is social media. Everybody has social media. LinkedIn, they're part of therapy groups on LinkedIn, trying to get those people to understand like what needs to be done. So I think that's easy and powerful. And people that are younger than us know how to do it better than we do. So
I'd have to leave them to them that. But yes, you're correct. Everyone's connected. Everyone has a network.
And I'll be the first one to admit, like, I filled that out, the form letter. It took me literally 3 minutes. Just getting your voice heard, I think, is the important piece. And again, it's going to touch all of us here, right? And I think even the innovation of physical therapy over the years, even when we're long gone out of the profession, it's still going to be innovating. There's still going to be people. We're going to be that population that's going to need the care. So why wouldn't we want to advocate for it, right? Where do you see the future of PT in general? I mean, I think it's one of those things we're always innovating and we're looking for, how do we get better at preventative care and how do we collaborate more? Where do you think we're going in that realm? I think because the only reason I ask that is because the Medicare, like that Medicare like, I guess, bubble above my head keeps flashing. Like, how does that drive us over the next, you know, decade or more?
Yeah, I think where we're going to end up, where we're going to need to end up, is therapists get to the point where when it comes to musculoskeletal disorders, we have to start owning that space. If we're going to be around in 20, 30 years, it's going to be because we finally laid claim to that space and said that we're the managers of those diagnoses. Again, much just like there's a very specified domain for cardiologists and, you know, where your oncologists sit and where your OBGYN, like there's an MSK space there, the non-operative MSK space where we just need to lay claim to. That's not the PCP space. We're better suited for that. So I think we need to lay claim to that. And I like to see a future where, again, we're not always the person you see after you've had the major injury. We're preventative. We're wellness. We're doing annual checkups on folks. The reason we will get there, like the pathway to get there, is by showing our cost effectiveness. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that's happening with us right now is every dollar is being examined so closely, and we do not have unlimited funds as a country to throw money at everything. There will be a need on the government side to gravitate toward the most efficient routes and the most cost efficient routes of care. And there'll be a need on PT side to lay claim to this non-operative MSK space, and where they intersect will be us laying claim to that with the data that we compile. So we have to begin now. We should have began, you know, yesterday on compiling the data that shows our cost effectiveness without compromising outcomes or even getting better outcomes. And we have to make the case so bluntly that forget, this is not a scope of practice issue. This is not a turf battle. This is not about us wanting to do more or less or disparaging another provider. This is about the best route of care for patients with the best use of limited dollars by payers. And it is by PTs owning the non-operative MSK space.
Yeah. And I think you said it best. I mean, I talked to Chuck Thigpen about this, and he's so passionate about outcomes. He talks about that. Like, if we can show that we have the top 90% of outcomes with our patients, and we can control that population in the MSK space, we know we're saving dollars upstream, right? So I think you have to look at it in a way that, how are we providing, you know, care first? I think the big thing is understanding that, like you said, and it's a key point, we're not stealing it from anybody. We're controlling what we can control by providing the best care with what we know best, which is MSK care. And I think the fall risk, if that passes and goes through, that fall risk assessment, I think that's going to be a huge game changer for us in that space.
Well, that opens the door, right? Because now the government actually will create the data for us, because they'll very easily be able to say who had the fall risk assessment, because they know they paid for that visit, and who didn't.
Right.
And then they'll take these two groups and say, well, how much should we pay on falls for the group that had the fall risk assessment?
Yeah.
And how much should we pay for falls of the groups that didn't? And there will be a delta there. And the only difference between the two will be, well, this group had therapy and one visit of it, and this group didn't. And now you're starting to set therapy up as the government's own data showing that we save money.
Uh-huh.
And again, that these are the things that open the door. So there is, yes, there is actually a provision in SAFE Act which mandates that report to come out. So as you're advocating for SAFE, you realize that that's our toehold to potentially a whole lot more stuff that we want to accomplish as a profession that's in there.
I have to tell you, we're going to keep pushing for it. We're going to keep advocating, pushing people to the site to be able to get letters out, get information out, talking to therapists, talking to clients about it, and patients, and making sure that we get the information out there, because you're doing a fantastic job and all of us appreciate it. That being said, what do you like to do in your free time when you're not trying to save the PT world?
Yeah, in the spare time, honestly, it's not just me. My entire family, we're a family of people that loves to travel. So we spend as much time as we can traveling and seeing as much of the world as possible. I think it makes you, one, it exposes you to a lot of the great things that the world has, but two, I think the more you travel the world, the more you have an appreciation for home when you come home, and you realize how lucky you are to live where you do live, but at the same time get exposed to a lot of the great things that the world has to offer. So that's probably the thing I enjoy the most.
Yeah, that's amazing, because I also love traveling, and I, like you had said, you appreciate where you are or where you live, because a lot of people don't understand what you take for granted when you're not in the United States, because there is a lot of things that happen around the world that you're really kind of, I think, numb to or don't see it. So right. It is important right. To get out there and do these things. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we are committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, in leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. This is your host, Andrew Rizza. If you enjoyed today's episode, give us a like, comment, and share it on social media. Access all of our episodes on platforms such as Apple, Spotify, or your preferred podcast app. Stay updated by following us on Instagram at Behind Sports Med Podcast, on X at AJR Sports Sci, or visiting our website at ajrsportsscience.podbean.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at AJR Sports Science for upcoming content. Thank you for tuning in, and stay tuned for our next episode.